If you were facing the very real possibility of imminent death, what would you do? How desperate would you become if you knew that your next meal could be your last meal? Questions such as these were not hypothetical for one particular group of pioneers traveling to California by wagon train in the winter of 1846. A group that became famously known as the Donner Party. Welcome to Narratives at Night, where every month this year we'll lift the rope and swim out to the deep end of the pool. I'm Mike Reagan, your host, and here is tonight's show. Part 1. To the brothers George and Jacob Donner, the way to California seemed clear and simple. Both in their 60s, solid and well-to-do, thanks to their own hard work, but beginning now to feel their age and the long Illinois winters in their bones, the two men sat in the glow of the hearth fire that winter of 1845-1846 and again reviewed the well-thumbed pages of The Immigrant's Guide to Oregon and California. With the snow piled outside and the Sangamon River lying frozen in its bed, the brothers read with wonder the book's description of a golden land. In California, winter was warmer than summer, said the author, one Lansford W. Hastings. Hollyhocks and Sweet William bloomed at Christmas time. Clover stood 5 feet high, and the cattle never had to be fed or housed. Here, perpetual summer is in the midst of unceasing winter. Perennial spring and never-failing autumn stand side by side, and towering snow-clad mountains forever look down upon eternal verdure. Oh yes, Oregon had its virtues, Hastings admitted. It was more like the country most Americans knew, green and wooded. And it was claimed by the United States, not by Mexico. Also, the trail was shorter. But for much of the year, Oregon was gray and misty. And the last stretch of the trail, the part that took you through the Cascades, was dreadfully difficult. No, it was better to try for California. Besides, said Hastings, it was possible to shorten the trip. All you had to do was follow the regular wagon route toward Fort Bridger, the road used by immigrants ever since the first small band of American settlers made its way overland in 1841. You started at the Missouri frontier town of Independence, headed northwest across the grassy plains of what is now Kansas and Nebraska, followed the North Fork of the Platte River to Fort Laramie, and continued westward to South Pass, the broad, gently sloping plain that took you over the crest of the Continental Divide. From there, you headed southwest to Fort Bridger. Then, instead of making the long northward swing to Fort Hall and down the Humboldt River, you took Hastings' shortcut, bearing west-southwest to the Salt Lake, and then continuing down to the Bay of San Francisco. What could be more sensible? Anyone who glanced at a map could see that the Fort Hall Trail made sense for Oregon, but not for California. Was it not reasonable to suppose that there was a more direct route across the still unmapped spaces that lay due west of Fort Bridger? Now here was this man Hastings saying it was so, and in print, between the polished leather covers of a book. So George and Jacob Donner made their decision. They would venture the new route and get to California just that much sooner. It was a decision that would have them remembering fondly, before another winter was out, the comforts of their Illinois homesteads. The trouble was that in 1845, when The Emigrant's Guide was published, neither its author nor anyone else had yet broken the new route to California. So far, the so-called shortcut existed only in Hastings' imagination. A restless young schemer from Ohio, in whose head swirled dreams of empire, Hastings had written his book and created the cutoff as a means of attracting enough American settlers to California to overthrow the Mexican regime and declare an independent republic. Then, of course, the new government would need leaders, and there he would be, Lansford Hastings himself, California's own Sam Houston. Unfortunately, the abstract logic of Hastings' new immigrant trail bore no relation to the uncompromising facts of geography. The country that Hastings so blithely swept away with his pen was some of the worst for wagon travel in the United States. Between Fort Bridger and the Great Salt Lake lay the Wasatch Range, boulder-strewn, canyon-cut, and covered in many places with miles of tangled scrub forest. And beyond the Salt Lake lay the alkaline wastes of the Great Salt Lake Desert. It was a country that the Rocky Mountain fur trappers had known and avoided for 20 years, but had failed to record except in their own heads. The fact was that in the spring of 1846, the general public had plenty of legend, but little hard information about the Far West. It was as though no white man had ever trod the Wasatch or the Salt Desert Wilderness. No map showed what the terrible country was like. John Charles Fremont, whose widely read accounts were full of wonderful descriptions and adventure stories, inspired any number of restless young Easterners to strike out for the far country, or to dream of doing so. But Fremont did not concern himself with opening new wagon routes, nor did he offer much information that would be useful to immigrants on the trail. Hence, the popularity of Hastings' Immigrant's Guide. Grossly inaccurate and not nearly so well written as Fremont's book, it nonetheless seemed to give the immigrants just what they needed: practical information about the Great Trek, how they could prepare for it, what they could expect along the way, and what they would find in the Promised Land. All up and down the Ohio and Mississippi valleys that winter, Hastings' book was being read, talked over, and passed from hand to hand. As to Hastings' proposed new route, vague as it was, there was about it that air of self-evident logic. Moreover, the theory of a more direct route seemed to be confirmed by Fremont's exploration of 1845. Arriving at Sutter's Fort, now Sacramento, at the end of that year, Fremont reported that he had crossed the Salt Desert and had pushed his way over the High Sierra just ahead of the snow. He was gaunt and worn from the ordeal, even though he had made the journey on horseback. Yet he declared grandly that the route he had just explored was decidedly better for wagons, being considerably shorter and less mountainous, with good pasturage and well watered. Fremont, it seems, was cut from the same cloth as Hastings. Both were optimistic to the point of being irresponsible. Encouraged by Fremont's report, Hastings started east from Sutter's Fort in mid-April 1846. To scout the trail for himself finally, and to persuade as many westward-bound immigrants as he could to follow him back to California. The party with which he traveled seems to have included a number of people who did not share his enthusiasm for the Golden Shore. As the saying went, they had seen the elephant and were going home. But Hastings was seldom perturbed by opposition, and at any rate, a man could not always choose his traveling companions. So the party moved east, over the Sierra, and along the Humboldt River Trail. A trickle of humanity against the westward tide. In Illinois, meanwhile, George and Jacob Donner, together with their friend James Fraser Reed, a local furniture manufacturer, prepared to join the more than 2,000 immigrants who were starting for Oregon and California that spring. Mustering in Springfield on April 15th, they made a bustling and prosperous confusion. Women in homespun, impatient to get started, white-topped wagons, dogs, children, high-booted teamsters, the unruly herd of cattle and horses. They were probably among the best of immigrants on the trail that year. The Donner brothers, with their wives, with 12 children between them, and with 4 young men hired to help with the animals, were setting off with 3 wagons apiece. One packed with goods to be used for setting up trade and housekeeping in California, one loaded with supplies for the journey, and one to live in. George Donner's wife, Tamsin, was taking watercolors, oil paints, and apparatus for preserving botanical specimens. She was bringing books and school supplies for the young lady's seminary she planned to establish in California. And she was bringing a quilt into which she had sewn $10,000 in banknotes. Reed, who was 46 years old, who had served in the Black Hawk War with a would-be politician named Abraham Lincoln, and who had later done well for himself in the furniture business, had loaded his 3 wagons with all the luxuries of a successful life, including cushions, bunks, a stove, and a store of gourmet wines and brandies. Heading west in hopes of improving his prosperity, he was traveling with his wife, his ailing mother-in-law, 4 children, and 5 employees, all in their 20s, and all Sangamon County neighbors. Bayless Williams, his sister Eliza, and 3 young men working their way west. This was the company that set out from Springfield on April 16th, heading west at last, along the muddy Illinois springtime roads. At different stages along the trail, the caravan was lengthened by the wagons of other travelers, the numbers fluctuating as immigrant parties grouped and regrouped. There was Patrick Breen, for one, rejoined up at Independence, bringing with him his wife, 6 sons, a daughter, and a friend named Patrick Dolan. Breen, a transplanted Irishman, had enjoyed enough success at farming on the Iowa side of the Mississippi Valley to be traveling with 3 wagons and his own substantial herd of horses and cattle. Then there was an Illinois carriage maker named William Eddy, with his wife and 2 children, and the Fosters, the Pikes, the Graveses, the Keysbergs and Wolfingers, both from Germany, the McCutcheons, a cutler named Harcoop, who was in his 60s, and various unattached young men. Among these last were a few who seemed to have come along simply for the adventure. But there were a number, among both the single men and the married, who neither shared the prosperity of the Donners and the Reeds, nor were particularly adventuresome, but who hoped only to escape the hard times that had beaten down so many people in the Mississippi Valley during the Depression of the late 30s and early 40s. In the West, at least, a man might still be able to buy land cheaply and get a fair price for the fruits of his labor. So, they had headed for Independence. And having traveled first with one party, then with another, as chance, convenience, and temperament seemed to dictate, they had fallen in at last with the Donners. One train, after all, was much like another. It was the people that made the difference. The numbers grew, and when the Donner party was complete, it contained a total of 87 men, women, and children. The trek was hard going right from the start. The immigrants were townspeople and farmers, not frontiersmen. They were used to having regular meals and a roof over their heads. For them, life on the trail took some getting used to. It was not just the strain of traveling for weeks at a time in an unknown country, but also of struggling with the cattle and of repairing broken wagons, of sleeping on the damp ground or on a hard wagon bed, of eating poorly, and of being soaked through by rain and blistered by the sun. Quarrels were frequent, even in the first days of the journey. Illness, too, was commonplace. Colds, bronchitis, agues, bouts of diarrhea. Reed's mother-in-law, Mrs. Sarah Keyes, aged and feeble, lasted only a few weeks. She was buried under an oak near the Big Blue River in May. The Donners and their friends were faring neither better nor worse than most bands of immigrants on the trail that spring. Indeed, they were even managing to enjoy themselves a little. Having joined an enormous train of 72 wagons, itself a conglomerate of smaller trains, they found in that village on wheels as much congenial company as they wished, more even than they had known at home. There were sewing circles, glee clubs, debating societies, open-air church services on Sundays, the pleasant rituals of the campfire, and any number of playmates for the children. And they enjoyed, as much as anyone, the ample beauties of the springtime prairie. That luxurious rolling plain of grass and wildflowers, where Dyrus waxed eloquent at the thought of prairie schooners sailing gracefully upon an emerald sea. But as they climbed the long slope toward the Rockies, a subtle change occurred. The heat of summer was coming on, and enthusiasm was giving way to boredom and a gnawing anxiety. The country, too, was different now. Instead of the broad, smooth prairie highway, the wagons had to be pulled through a hard, dry land that was cut up by ravines and dusty, alkaline hills. Water and grass had grown scarce, and now there were Indians to worry about. This was Pawnee country, and a man had to be constantly on his guard to prevent his cattle from being driven off or himself from falling behind and becoming a victim of a Pawnee raiding party. Tempers flared, and quarrels turned into fistfights. The big parties began splitting up. Then came new frustrations. Just east of Fort Laramie, the now fragmented party, to which the Donners were attached, met up with a grubby old wanderer named James Clyman, who told them that Hastings' route was a mistake. Clyman, it turned out, was an old friend of James Reed, a mountain man who had first crossed the Missouri in 1823, had later settled in Illinois and Wisconsin, and had been in the same company as Reed and Lincoln during the Black Hawk War. Restlessness had turned his needle for California in 1844. But this spring of 1846, satisfied that there was little promise in the Promised Land, he had started for home, traveling east with Lansford Hastings over the very trail the immigrants were planning to take. That trail, Clyman had found, was appallingly difficult, even on horseback. Hastings was waiting at Fort Bridger to tell the immigrants otherwise. But Clyman, nominating himself a one-man safety committee, was riding ahead to warn everyone he met against taking the supposed shortcut. Now, on this night of June 27, 1846, he found himself sitting beside an immigrant campfire, telling his friend Reed and a number of other wagon captains, including probably George and Jacob Donner, about the terrible country they would encounter if they took Hastings' route. Clyman's advice, as he later recalled in his journal, was for the immigrants to stick to the regular wagon route.
"It is barely possible to get through if you follow it," he told them, "and may be impossible if you don't."
No one welcomed the news. It was too disheartening to think of stretching their tedious journey still further by making the long swing north to Fort Hall. Besides, they were already beginning to feel the pressure of time. By their constant quarreling and reorganizing, By taking time out for fishing and sightseeing and fistfights, they had fallen behind schedule. After 2 months of travel, they were barely a third of the way to California. At this rate, they would not get to the Sierra until the end of October, when they would be running low on provisions and when the mountain passes were likely to be blocked by snow. Fear of such a prospect had already prompted one of those at the campfire, a Louisville newspaper man named Edwin Bryant, to trade his wagon and oxen for mules and pack saddles. Several of his companions had done likewise. Bryant put Kleiman down for a liar, suspecting ulterior motives, though he had no idea what they might be. Another wagon captain, an old Santa Fe trader and former governor of Missouri named Lilburn Boggs, took just the opposite view. Impressed by Kleiman's report, he decided to take his party to Oregon by way of Fort Hall. But Reed held out. Did Hastings' book count for nothing? And all those months of planning? Tense and irritable, Reed spoke up.
"There is a nigher route," he insisted, "and it is of no use to take so much of a roundabout course."
So, in the end, it came down to the word of one man against another. The word of Kleiman, who had no more to his name than a pack and a horse and a timber claim in Wisconsin, and that probably worthless. Against the word of a man who had written a book. No, Reed would go the way he had planned, and the Donners would go with him. They were respectable men. They listened to respectable voices. One chronicler, an Oregon-bound immigrant who took leave of the Donner Party a short time later, noted in his journal that the Californians were generally much elated and in fine spirits with the prospect of a better and nearer road to the country of their destination. Mrs. George Donner, Tamsin, was an exception. She was gloomy, sad, and dispirited, in view of the fact that her husband and others could think for a moment of leaving the old road and confide in the statement of a man of whom they knew nothing, but who was probably some selfish adventurer. Yet the soundness of their judgment seemed only to be confirmed when, having trekked across the Wyoming desert and up the long slope to South Pass, Reed and the Donner brothers came down on the westward side of the Great Divide and rolled up to Jim Bridger's ramshackle trading post. There they found that a large party of immigrants had already started westward over the new trail, with Hastings himself at its head. Bryant's party, too, had stuck to its plan, despite his misgivings, and was taking the new route. Even better, here was Jim Bridger himself, one of the greatest mountain men of all, telling them just what they wanted to hear, that the new trail was open and easy, and that Hastings would be marking the route for those who followed. Perhaps it was Bridger's name. Perhaps it was his manner. Or perhaps it was their own anxieties and frustrations that prompted Reed and the Donner brothers to trust old Gabe, where they had failed to trust Kleiman. In any case, their trust was misplaced. Bridger was lying. Why? Old Gabe had his reasons. 2 years before, a new shortcut had been established between South Pass and Fort Hall, one that bypassed Fort Bridger and so threatened to put its proprietor out of business. If, by some fluke, Hastings and his followers did stumble on a new route out of Fort Bridger, why then old Gabe stood to regain his share of the immigrant trade. But the members of the Donner Party knew nothing of Bridger's motives. They took him at his word. The matter was settled. After stopping a few days to rest the oxen, the party left Fort Bridger on the last day of July and headed west toward the Wasatch Range. Meanwhile, the parties that had gone ahead were finding the trail infinitely more difficult than Hastings had led them to believe. Even Bryant and his friends, mounted though they were on mules, were almost beaten by the rugged canyons of the Wasatch, and they were half dead with thirst before they got across the Salt Desert. For the party of wagons led by Hastings, the journey was hellish. called the Harlan Young Party, after two of its captains, it consisted of four fragmentary trains, totaling about 60 wagons. Having been delayed on the trail, and having found Hastings himself awaiting them at Fort Bridger, the leaders of the party had been persuaded to risk the new route in hopes of saving time. Hastings, confident as ever, had agreed to guide them. At last, he had found his following. After that, his only problem was deciding where to lead them. Hoping to find an easier route over the Wasatch than the one he and Kleiman had traveled on their eastward journey, Hastings led them straight into the narrow canyon on the Weber River, where the wagons at times had to be alternately driven and floated in the riverbed, and at other times dragged up and over the sheer cliffs with a windlass. Once on the desert, 80 miles of glaring salt and sand instead of the 40 that Hastings had promised, oxen died and wagons were abandoned. The sun wore down even the strongest men. Eventually, the party found its way to the Humboldt River. But instead of gaining time, the emigrants had lost nearly 3 weeks. Hastings' cutoff had proved to be not only more difficult, but also 125 miles longer than the Fort Hall route. When the Harlan Young Party crossed the Sierra in early October, the snow was already beginning to fly. They were the last party on the trail that year, except for that of the Donner Brothers. New episodes of Narratives at Night will be released every month on various platforms, including Google Podcast, Spotify, and Apple Podcast. If you really like this podcast, go to Apple Podcast and give the show a 5-star rating and help the podcast grow its listenership. To hear more samples of my work, go to voiceswithmike.com. Have a great evening.